Welcome to History Class After Hours. I'm Joseph Barra, and joining me is Brian.
Woo!
Back for a new year.
Yeah, 2024.
It's going to be a good one.
New year, pretty much the same me. Yeah.
You got a Dodgers sweatshirt on.
Yes. Well, I've always been a Dodgers fan.
Most hated people in baseball right now.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's good, but bad.
Yeah, if you don't win the World Series, it's World Series or bust at this point.
Uh-huh. If we're going to lose to, like, the, like, 87-win Rockies first round.
Yeah, that's foreseeable. Yep.
Yeah.
My team has no chance. They're going to lose 110 games.
So.
I'm the White Sox fan. They're pure trash. So, anyway.
I'm very sorry about that.
Speaking of, we're going to talk about a blimp today.
Ooh.
A blimp that has a issue. And that blimp's name is the Hindenburg. It was a big-time disaster back in the late 30s. Big-time international incident.
Yep.
So the Hindenburg was the last passenger aircraft of the world's first airline.
Huh.
Her chief steward was the first flight attendant in history. And she was the Hindenburg was the fastest way to cross the Atlantic back in the late 30s.
Wow, it made it Atlantic.
Hindenburg's passengers could travel from Europe to North and South America in half the time of the fastest ocean liner at that time.
And how long was that?
I think it was like a week, so maybe like 3 or 4 days.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. They had luxurious interiors that would never again be matched in the air. They enjoyed meals. It was basically like a cruise in the air, if you've ever been on a cruise.
I feel like we need to bring blimps back. Like, not Hindenburg. Like, don't bring that back. But, like, safer blimps, you know.
Oh, I say we just go for the Hindenburg.
Oh.
I think it was a fluke.
Like, with all the hydrogen?
Maybe. Maybe we'll go a safer route.
Yeah.
But,
that's
what
I was talking
air travel
about,
like that. This kind of seems like a what are you doing type thing. It also had a cigarette and cigar shop on board with a smoking room.
That's not good.
You know how you know when you're on a really old airplane?
When there's like a cigarette.
When there's ashtrays in the seat still. That's crazy to think about too, is that up until like the 90s, people were like still able to smoke on airplanes.
Yeah, that's.
Wow. But all this luxury would come to an end in 32 seconds when it goes boom. And that is what we are going to be talking about today, the Hindenburg disaster. Almost 80 years of research and scientific tests support the same conclusion reached by original German and American accident investigations in 1937. It seems clear that the Hindenburg disaster was caused by a electrostatic discharge that ignited leaking hydrogen. Now, there's all sorts of theories around, like, how this thing exploded. Some was sabotage. That was, the number one kind of idea, but they got hit by lightning was another idea. There's all sorts of theories. The spark was most likely caused by a difference in electrical potential between the airship and surrounding air. To me, that sounds like static electricity, no?
Yeah.
Okay.
Lightning. Yeah.
The airship was approximately 200 feet above the airfield in an electrically charged atmosphere, but the ship's metal framework was grounded by its landing line. Difference in electric potential likely caused a spark to jump from the ship's fabric covering, which had the ability to hold a charge, to the ship's framework, which was grounded through the landing line. A somewhat less likely but still plausible theory attributes the spark to a coronal discharge most likely known as St. Elmo's fire. You ever heard of that term before?
Coronal discharge?
Or St. Elmo's fire?
I've heard of coronal discharge. That's like when the sun
shoots out something.
Yeah, I don't know what St. Elmo's fire is though.
It's a movie in the 80s. A hit song in the 1980s. The theme song of the movie. But that's the second time I've seen St. Elmo's fire in like the last couple of weeks. Maybe I should actually figure out what that is.
Oh, I think they mentioned it in like The Lighthouse. Lighthouse. Not as like the movie or something, but like, have you seen The Lighthouse? Oh, very freaky.
William Dafoe?
Yeah, and Robert Pattinson. They're like the only two cast members. It's very like, it's like a psychological thriller. Okay. It's really good.
I'm a big William Dafoe fan, so maybe I'll check it out.
Yeah.
I guess my wife's father grew up next to William Dafoe.
Oh, really?
They were like neighbors growing up.
Wow.
He's from like Northwoods, Wisconsin.
Oh.
No evidence of sabotage was ever found, and no convincing theory of sabotage has ever been advanced. One thing is clear. The disaster had nothing to do with the Zeppelin's fabric covering being highly flammable for one simple reason. It wasn't.
Huh?
The fabric wasn't flammable, and everyone's like, oh, that's why it exploded.
Oh.
In fact, Hindenburg was just one of many hydrogen airships destroyed by fire because of their flammable lifting gas. Who knew that hydrogen was explosive?
Like everyone?
Apparently not. Apparently this is a...
I thought people knew that.
This is an unknown thing in the 1930s, that hydrogen...
I thought people had known that by then, but I guess not.
I guess not.
Yeah.
So the last flight of the Hindenburg began on May 3rd, 1937. It was carrying 36 passengers, 61 officers. That seems like an awful lot.
Yeah.
61 officers, crew members, and trainees. Still seems like a lot. That's like a 2-to-1 differential. Yeah. And it was the airship's 63rd flight. So it has been doing this for a while. The ship left the Frankfurt airfield at 7:16 p.m. and flew over Cologne, beautiful city, by the way, one of the coolest churches I've ever seen, and then crossed the Netherlands before following the English Channel past the cliffs of Beachy Head in southern England and then heading out over the Atlantic shortly after 2 a.m. the next day. Hindenburg followed a northern track across the ocean, passing the southern tip of Greenland and crossing the North American coast of Newfoundland. Headwinds delayed the airship's passage across the Atlantic and the Lakehurst arrival, which was in New Jersey, which had been scheduled for 6 a.m. on May 6. It was postponed to 6 p.m. Look at that. My estimate was right. 3 days.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know it only took like a week to get it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A modern ship liner.
Wow.
I think it's even like 3 or 4 days now.
Man, I didn't know they went that fast.
I know Carnival Cruise actually does a trip that leaves like New Jersey or somewhere on the East Coast and goes across the Atlantic, and then there's like a Mediterranean type cruise. By noon on May 6th, the ship had reached Boston, and by 3 p.m., Hindenburg was over the skyscrapers of Manhattan in New York City. And there's some really cool pictures of it actually. The ship flew south from New York and arrived at the Naval Air Station at Lakehurst, New Jersey at around 4:15 p.m., but the poor weather conditions at the field concerned Hindenburg's commander, Captain Max Preuss, and also Lakehurst's commanding officer, Charles Rosendahl.
Max what?
Preuss!
Okay.
P-R-U-S-S.
Oh, all right.
What do you think about
it? I don't know. I thought there was like a T at the end.
Oh, no. Preuss.
Okay.
Not Prost. Or Prost, which is cheers in German.
Oh.
And you're supposed to stare at the person in the eyes. Direct eye contact. You go, Prost.
Ah.
Yes.
I feel like I've seen that before.
So if you ever go to Germany, make sure your eye contact's really important.
I don't know if I'd be allowed to. Oh, wait.
You would be. Yeah.
I would be.
You would be, yeah. By 6 p.m., conditions had improved. At 6:12, Rosendahl sent Preuss a message relaying temperature, pressure, visibility, and winds, which Rosendahl considered suitable for landing. At 6:22, Rosendahl radioed Preuss, recommended landing now. And at 7:08, Rosendahl sent a message to the ship strongly recommending the earliest possible landing. Who knew that landing a blimp was so complicated? You would just kind of float down. Hindenburg approached the field at Lakehurst from the southwest shortly after 7 p.m. at an altitude at approximately 600 feet. Since the wind was from the east, after passing over the field to observe conditions on the ground, Preuss initiated a wide left turn to fly a descending oval pattern around the north and west of the field to line up for a landing into the wind to the east. While Captain Preuss was directing the ship's heading and engine power settings, He brought Hindenburg around the field. First officer Albert Sumpt was responsible for the trim and altitude. And then they're assisted by watch officer Walter Ziegler at the gas board.
I guess that's where you, like, control the hydrogen?
I'm assuming so. And then there's a second officer, Henrik Bauer, at the ballast board. Which I would think that would be releasing gas.
Yeah, that's like
gas.
Releasing weight. And stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Sandbags.
Valved 15 seconds of hydrogen along the length of the ship to reduce Hindenburg's buoyancy in preparation for landing. I'm kind of curious how this thing works.
Yeah.
You can't add hydrogen.
No.
So they must have a bunch of weight on it. Be pre-takeoff. Reduce the weight, let it float up, and then just casually
release
hydrogen.
Yeah,
okay.
I guess.
Man, let's build a blimp. Think we got that in us?
Maybe.
As Proust continued the slow left turn of the oval landing pattern, reducing and then reversing the power from the engines, Samp noticed that the ship was heavy in the tail and valved hydrogen from cells 11 through 16 for a total of 30 seconds to reduce the buoyancy of the bow and keep the ship level. When this failed to level, Samp ordered 3 drops of water ballast. All right, so that's where they're getting the weight from. They got water tanks. From ring 77 in the tail, and then valved an additional 5 seconds of hydrogen from the forward gas cells. When even these measures could not keep the ship in a level trim, 6 crewmen were ordered to go forward to add their weight to the bow. Seems like things are...
Not going well.
Yeah, they're kind of losing control of the ship.
Yeah.
While Samp was working to keep the ship in trim, the wind shifted direction from east to southwest. Captain Proust now needed to land into the wind on a southwesterly heading rather than the easterly heading he had originally intended when he planned his oval landing pattern. Hindenburg was now close to the landing area. However, it did not have a lot of room to maneuver before reaching the mooring mast. Anxious to land quickly before the weather conditions deteriorated, Captain Proust decided to execute a tight S-turn to change the direction of the ship's landing. Proust ordered a turn to port to swing out and then a sharp, tight turn to starboard to line up for landing into the wind. So some experts will say that all of this erratic movement was way too much for the ship and it started to break apart. And that may have been what caused the hydrogen leak.
Okay.
Because it's a blimp.
Yeah.
It's not a drifter, drifting race car. Or it's not an F-16. It's not meant to be doing these tight maneuvers. So after the S-turn to change the direction of landing, Proust continued his approach to the mooring mast, adjusting power from the 2 forward and 2 rear engines. And at 7:21, with the ship about 180 feet above the ground, the forward landing ropes were dropped. A few minutes after the landing lines were dropped, R.H. Ward, in charge of the port bow landing party, noticed what he described as a wave-like fluttering of the outer cover on the port side. He testified at the Commerce Department inquiry that it appeared to him as if gas were pushing against the cover, having escaped from a gas cell. Ground crew member R.W. Antrim, who was at the top of the mooring mast, also testified that he saw the covering behind the rear port engine fluttering. At 7:25, the first visible external flames appeared. Reports vary, but most witnesses saw the first flames either at the top of the hull, just forward of the vertical fin, or between the rear port engine and the port fin. For example, Lakehurst Commander Rosendahl described a mushroom-shaped flower of flame bursting into bloom in front of the upper fin. Navy Lieutenant Benjamin May, the assistant mooring officer who was atop the mooring mast, testified that an area just behind the rear port engine seemed to collapse, after which he saw streaks of flame followed by a muffled explosion, and then the entire tail was engulfed by flame. Navy ground crew member William Bishop described seeing flames inside the ship, a little above the aft of the rear port engine car. So all these things together, the fire started in the back. Several witnesses inside the ship also saw the beginning of the fire. Helmsman Helmut Lau, who was stationed at the auxiliary control stand in the lower fin, heard a muffled detonation and looked up and saw from the starboard side down inside the gas cell a bright reflection on the front bulkhead of cell number 4. What is a muffled detonation? Is it just like,
maybe.
Is that like boom? It's like boom. I don't know. Lau described the flames he saw at cell number 4 at the inquiry. The bright reflection in the cell was inside. I saw it through the cell. It was at first red and yellow, and there was smoke in it. The cell did not burst on the lower side. The cell suddenly disappeared by the heat. The fire proceeded further down and then got air. The flame became very bright, and the fire rose up to the side, more to the starboard side, as I remember seeing it. And I saw that with the flame, aluminum parts and fabric parts were thrown up. So apparently there was an explosion. At that time, parts of girders, molten aluminum, and fabric parts started to tumble down from the top. Man, that burnt. That must burn hot.
Yeah, if it's like melting.
Aluminum that fast? The whole thing only lasted a fraction of a second.
Wow.
You're a science guy. How
kinda.
How hot does it have to be for aluminum to melt?
I don't think it's like as hot as like steel, but it's
still pretty.
Yeah, because it's still like a metal. You
know? Mm-hmm.
So it's gotta be kind of. I don't know. I'm. Chemistry was one of my lowest grades.
Oh, sorry.
It was still like.
The fire quickly spread and soon engulfed the tail of the ship, but the ship remained level for a few more seconds before the tail began to sink and the nose pointed upward in the sky. With a blowtorch of a flame erupting from the bow where the 12 crew members were stationed, including the 6 who were sent forward to keep the ship trim. In the port and statebird promenades on the passenger decks where many of the passengers and some of the crew had gathered to watch the landing. The rapidly increasing angle of the ship caused passengers and crew to tumble against the walls, the furniture, and each other. Passenger Margaret Mather recalled being hurled 15 to 20 feet against the rear wall of the dining room and being pinned against a bench by several other people.
Wait, so there were like actually people who like survived
mm-hmm.
a huge explosion and then falling to the ground?
Based off the video that was taken of it,
it wasn't like that.
It wasn't just like a. They were like a couple of hundred feet off the ground. And the video, like the tail end erupts and then it just kind of flutters down.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
The fire spread so quickly, consuming the ship in less than a minute, that survival was largely a matter of where one happened to be located when the fire broke out. Passengers and crew members began jumping out the promenade windows to escape the burning ship. Most of the passengers and all the crew who were in the public rooms on A deck at the time of the fire, close to the promenade windows, did survive. Those who were deeper inside the ship in the passenger cabins at the center of the decks or the crew spaces along the keel generally died in the fire. One passenger, John Panis, was in the dining room when the fire broke out, encouraged to jump by ship's photographer Carl Otto Clemens, who escaped through one of the windows and survived. Panis instead left the dining room to find his wife Emma, who had returned to their cabin for their coat. Both will die in the fire. Well, that's sad. Mr. and Miss Herman Doner and their 3 children, Irene, 16, Walter, 10, and Werner, 8, were also in the dining room watching the landing, but Mr. Doner left before the fire broke out. Miss Doner and her 2 young sons jumped to safety, but Irene left the dining room in search of her father, and both died as a result of the crash. So it definitely appears that if you were in the dining room, you survived. If you were anywhere else, you did not. Given the speed at which Hindenburg burned, survival of the crew was also largely a matter of luck. As the diagram, some diagrams show, those who were close to a means of exit at the time of the fire generally survived, including 9 of the 11 men in the engine cars and 10 of the 12 men in the control car. Those who were deep inside the ship, such as electricians in the power room along the keel, and Max Schluss, who was in the smoking bar, did not. They were trapped. And also the 9 men who were closest to the fire when it broke out died. As the ship settled to the ground less than 30 seconds after the flames were observed, those who had jumped from the burning craft scrambled for safety, as did members of the ground crew who had been positioned on the field below the ship. Natural instinct caused those on the ground to run from the burning wreck as fast as they could, but Chief Petty Officer Frederick J. Bull Tobin, a longtime airship veteran and an enlisted airship pilot who was in charge of the Navy landing party, cried out to the sailors, "Navy men, stand fast." Bull Tobin had survived the crash of the USS Shenandoah, and he was not about to abandon those in peril on an airship, even if it meant his own life. As his sailors agreed, films of the disaster clearly show sailors turning and running back towards the burning ship to rescue survivors. Those films are a permanent tribute to the courage of the sailors at Lakehurst that day.
Beat Army. Go Navy.
Yeah, so there's a video of this. Basically, there was a radio guy that he was there, and he was, I guess, like live broadcast were not really a thing yet.
Yeah.
Like on the scene type broadcast. So he wanted to go test this out with the Hindenburg coming in. So he was there kind of recording the Hindenburg coming in and it landing. And he was famously there when the thing just erupted in flames. And if you listen to it, he's just like hysterical. And then he has the infamous line, "Oh, the humanity."
Is that the first time that like was said?
I don't know if it's the first time it's said, but I mean, but like
the first use in like media.
Yeah, wow. I think so. And then eventually they were filming it, and they overlapped them. Mm. And the only reason why I know this was back in the mid-90s, uh-huh, when computers were still relatively archaic.
Yeah.
They had these things called CD-ROMs. It was a CD, it was Encyclopedia Britannica, CD-ROM, and it was mind-blowing. There was videos on it.
What?
Uh-huh. These little tiny boxes. They have really grainy videos on them, and one of them is the Hindenburg disaster.
Man.
And we watched that over and over again because it was just, what is this sorcery on my computer? And it's just the guy going, "Oh, the humanity." But yeah, if you want to check it out, it's on YouTube. I'm sure of that.
All right.
So Hindenburg left Frankfurt with 97 people on board. 67 survived the crash.
Oh, that's...
Although many suffered serious injuries from the fall and burns, 13 of the 36 passengers and 22 of the 61 crew died as a result of the crash, along with one member of the civilian landing party. The public seemed remarkably forgiving of the accident-prone Zeppelin prior to the Hindenburg disaster, and the glamorous and speedy Hindenburg was greeted with public enthusiasm despite a long list of previous airship incidents. So apparently... blimps weren't that safe.
Oh.
Maybe that's why we never brought them back. But while airships like USS Akron, which exploded over the ocean, that killed 73 people, there was a British blimp, British R-101, where 48 people were killed. None of them really had witnesses, or none of them were recorded, but the Hindenburg was.
Yeah.
And so... just like social media today, quickly everybody starts seeing the Hindenburg disaster with the call, "Oh, the humanity." And pretty much after that, no one wants to be on a blimp anymore.
Yeah. I feel like today we could make like a safer blimp, you know, like one that...
yes, that doesn't explode.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that shouldn't be too hard given technology today. I mean, we can make... huge like parade floats. Who says we can't make
it? That's true. And we got the Goodyear blimp. That thing hasn't come down.
Not yet, at least.
I've seen the Goodyear blimp before.
Oh, really?
Not like at a sporting event, like just kind of like going somewhere.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. On November 22nd, 1935, 3 months before the Hindenburg first took place, so you have Pan American Airways M130 China Clipper made the first scheduled flight across the Pacific. This is a plane. So this is what's really going to kill the Hindenburg.
All right.
The M130 could have crossed the Atlantic with ease. It had a 2,400-mile route from San Francisco to Honolulu, which was longer than the distance of the Atlantic. And it could do it a lot faster. And it was a lot more reliable. And the cost was far less.
So basically, blimps are obsolete.
Yes.
Okay.
But I think that's what I mean.
Like, I mean, you get there faster, but it's not a blimp.
I think people would be willing to pay for the experience.
Yeah.
Of basically being like
it's on just like a cruise.
A cruise in the air.
Yeah.
Yes.
That would be cool.
Unless it explodes.
Yeah. Well, just don't make it explode.
That's true. I feel like we have the means to make safe blimps at this point.
Just don't use high.
There you go. That's what your career path should be.
Maybe.
You should be like the
how to make a safe Hindenburg.
You should be the Elon Musks of blimps.
All electric blimps with self-driving capability.
There you go. And just put solar panels all around the outside of it to power it.
That could work. Maybe. I'm not sure. I'm not a big science guy.
Now you have something to strive for.
Yeah. Learn how blimps
Brian's work. Blimps. All right. Well, that was the Hindenburg disaster. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for tuning in to History Class After Hours, the show where we talk about the things your history teachers didn't have time to teach you. If you wanted to stay updated on upcoming events for the History Club, please visit www.starsmillhistoryc.wixsite.com/2020. If you liked this episode, please share it with your friends and subscribe to our channel on iTunes Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. Be on the lookout for new episodes, and we'll be posting every week. Until next time, stay curious.